Okay, thanks. So, well, first about that t-shirt. So Joe yesterday said people are running around with funny t-shirts with their favorite formulas, and I wanted to bring an N equals 4 t-shirt, but I picked this one up at CERN, and for some reason I don't quite understand, they only have N equals 0 t-shirt. So, but I guess if you cover that stuff, which, by the way, of course, all the activity in CERN now is about, but if you forget that for the moment, then you are left with, I guess, a 10-dimensional way to write N equals 4. So this talk is supposed to be an introductory and overview talk. There's no way to really give lectures in 1.5 hours on the subject. It's very big now. And actually, I just sort of want to give you a little bit of an outlook and especially stress a little bit the things we don't understand. And that's what this workshop is all about. That's why we are doing it, because indeed I want to convince you that it's an exciting problem and that it's far from solved and understood. Now, about these kind of titles which contain questions, there are sort of two theorems about them. Theorem one is about the case when the answer to the question is yes or no. And then theorem one says that if it's a physics talk, the answer is always no. If this doesn't apply because the answer doesn't take the form of yes or no, then theorem two comes into play. And theorem two says that usually means that the speaker doesn't know the answer. I'm sure you didn't forget yesterday's talk. So let me start then. Let me just say a few general remarks. Of course, everyone here, I'm assuming, knows about ADS-CFT, so let's just remind ourselves of a few facts which are somehow in the background of all this, what we are doing here. So somehow it's important to form this Toft coupling constant lambda, which you get by multiplying the number of colors of SUN gauge with the Baer-Young-Wills coupling. And the Baer-Young-Wills coupling is also the Drest-Young-Wills coupling because, as you know, nothing is running, so it's just a parameter in this model. And there is a very mysterious question in this ADS-CFT also, namely, for some reason, which I think nobody understands, so finiteness on N=4 just says that it doesn't run logarithmically, but the scale is not replaced by the scale. But it doesn't mean that there couldn't be a finite renormalization. And for some very mysterious reason, in this N equals 4 model and ADS-CFT, there doesn't seem to be even finite renormalization unless you do something really stupid, like you use a non-supersymmetric regulator or some crap like that. But if you do anything that sort of respects supersymmetry, it doesn't even pick up finite corrections, so it seems. So at least, that's a claim, but it's supported just by the fact that so many people did so many different kinds of calculations in this model, and never any discrepancies which sometimes appear and then go away again have ever been explained with some kind of finite renormalization problem. And the other thing is why you can see that there's something special here is this new model, which people are discussing now, and where it's somehow less clear, but it's integrable. I mean, the CFT3 stuff. In that, it seems like there is some kind of finite renormalization going on. So it's really not automatic. And I hope that the final solution of the planar limit will elucidate this point. Now you relate this to string theory, and the tension in units of the joint radius of the sphere and ADS radius r is, of course, square root lambda. And 4 pi times the string coupling constant is actually not 1 over n, as in Toft's original paper, but lambda over n, which is also somehow curious. So that is actually, in terms of, so there, I mean, original parameters just g r mu squared and not 1 over n. The statement is that somehow the string theory and the strongest statement is that somehow the string theory and the gauge theory are identical even at finite values of n. Now that's, I think, very little sort of dynamical work has been done on this, and it's actually a very tricky point. I mean, I remember a few months back I gave a talk in Berlin to some mathematicians about all this, and just explaining a bit about ADS-CFT. And there was a mathematician, his name is Baer. He asked me a very smart question, which I couldn't answer, maybe you guys can. And he said, so if this is supposed to be an exact duality, how can it be that the one model has one continuous parameter and one discrete parameter, and the other model has two continuous parameters? To a mathematician, this is crazy. And I think it's a very good comment. Okay, but still, if you take these relations completely serious, it's still true that you're mapping a model with two smooth parameters to a model with a...
You've got to remember, for the string theory, we have no definition, no way of defining or formulating string theory for finite
Constant. No, it has something to do with this question. I mean...
So if this, establishing a sort of same...
Yeah, but that would be. But some people seem to be making stronger statements than that. I mean, the so-called strongest version of ADS-CFT says that also SU2 NX4 gauge theory somehow is related to highly non-perturbative string theory.
Well, you can give several arguments. For one thing, you can go out on the Coulomb branch, where you have small subgroups unbroken, and almost by continuity. By continuity, you really derive the duality for the subgroup for the smaller n. Mm-hmm. But the small question, the immediate question is what it's Nassim, I think, said, that r squared over alpha prime cannot take continuous values. It takes values restricted by...
I of course I know that because of this construction with the flux, but still, I mean, in the end... what I'm saying is this dictionary is not good enough, clearly, for really, ultimately...
Actually, it's an interesting question, by the way, what happens to integrability if you go down the Coulomb branch? Mm-hmm. Because you're the same theory, but in a background with much less symmetry than the Coulomb variance. But aside from that, suppose I pull 6 D brains out of the bunch. Then I have a geometry which is locally the n equals 6 the charge 6 version of ADS space. And in the gauge theory, I have a U6, I mean, I have a U6 subgroup which is coupled to the rest only by... So, I mean, I think that... It's easy to motivate the finite n version. I mean, the simplest thing is just the fact that the supergravity theory knows that n is an integer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's very striking.
All right.
So, I think you can, if we sat here for a while, mm-hmm. we could think of more and more things that work at integer n.
Right.
And it would be very hard to think of a scenario in which the duality weren't true.
Right. I guess I mostly wanted to say that, I mean, we are really, this success for activity for the moment is really at G string equals zero. And the next step will be relaxing that and understanding this asymptotic expansion. And then finally, it would be nice to make sense of, say, SU2 n equals 4 as a string theory, because that would also maybe give a hint about whether somehow QCD. SU3 QCD could also be some string theory. I mean, that's all I wanted to say. So now these things, of course, share this invariance under PSU 2.2/4. And in just one moment, I will torture you a lot with this algebra, because I think it's very, very important and somehow contains a secret. Now, of course, there's further symmetries. And that's another very, very sort of puzzling and striking thing. So of course, in the gauge theory, you can also replace Chiang-Mills and actually yet another parameter which I didn't write, namely the theta angle, by writing tau equals theta over 2 pi plus 4 pi I 1 over Chiang-Mills squared, which is theta over 2 pi plus 4 pi I n over lambda. And then, as you know, if I don't do this soft rescaling, then of course there's this shift tau goes to tau plus 1 and the theta angle. So the theta is related to the expectation value of the axion, the string side. So under this shift, but then there's a more exciting, so this is just shifting the angle, exciting shift, which, I mean, where you replace tau by minus 1 over tau, and that at theta equals 0, it replaces Chiang-Mills by 1 over Chiang-Mills. So n equals 4 is supposed to have this amazing self-duality. And actually, this, these two generators, of course, as you all know, generate an SL2Z. Now, it's very curious also, thinking about symmetries, that somehow this is a symmetry which is precisely actually killed in this planar limit. Because from what I did here, you see now, since theta is an angle and is only from 0 to 2 pi, in order to get the meaningful complex coupling tau in the large n limit, since lambda is kept finite, I also need to rescale tau, and then theta just gets suppressed, which is usually the argument why also there's no why perturbation theory is planar with finite radius of convergence at finite lambda. But it's somehow a little bit funny that you somehow seem to do something brutal to some of the symmetries of this model. And then even though you kill some of the symmetries, suddenly you make progress. So how can that be? And I think that's the other thing we ultimately want to understand from this exact solvability. So somehow when you do this, something very strange happens to this PSU 2.2/4. There must be something one we might eventually call planar representation theory, whatever that means. Because this somehow, of course, the PSU 2 to 4 is always there at finite Chiang-Mills n. But then in this planar limit, you kill this SL2Z, but then you suddenly get an infinite sequence of extra U1 charges, infinitely many, which you can sort of show disappear when you look, take into account one of n corrections, but there you gain them in the planar limit, and they are responsible for the solvability. And they are also, so that's very puzzling to me, that you kill something and gain something. And they are also interesting because they also tell you why, even the, so the SU2.2 bosonic subgroup of PSU2.4 is, of course, a conformal group in four dimensions. And you know the nice thing that happens in two dimensions, that the SL2C gets augmented. I mean, in two dimensions, you have this lift from just L0 plus minus and L bar 0 plus minus to this full LN and LN bar, right? Infinite algebra. And that leads to the solvability. And actually, there's also a supposedly, according to Bajanov and Zamolodchikov and Lukyanov, some hidden integrable structure in conformal field theory as such. Now something somehow, and then you always, when you study the books on CFT2, you hear that, you know, this can only happen two dimension, and it couldn't happen, say, for SU2.2, which is a conformal group in four dimensions. But then it somehow can happen nevertheless. So somehow this, at least to my mind, this extension by to suddenly an infinite algebra is somehow replaced here, that this SU2.2 gets extended by this infinitely many U1s. Okay, so that's that was just general stuff. Now I'll spend a lot of time to talk about this PSU2.4.
So these U1s commute with the PSU2.4, so they're not like the non-local versions of the...
That's right. It's not some kind of term, let's say it's not some infinite dimensional Lie algebra.
It's not related to the non-local conserved kind.
Well, but you see, also, then there's this funny thing that actually this is sort of on shell in some sense. And you somehow, in this integrability, I mean, these U1s have also something to do with all these Youngian operators, and there's this integrability. So somehow there's an infinite dimensional algebra behind. And then somehow the U1s are only the local version of these infinitely many charges.
I guess I'm confused now, too. I thought it was the non-local charge, but it was just the traces of them.
I meant the traces here versus U1s, but...
So it's the traces, they're non-local, but they're traced, so that's how they become U1s.
Right, but probably, I mean, there's also the untraced ones.
Right, those you haven't written because...
Yeah, and then they probably clash with PSU224. That's somehow what happens.
I think they exist. I mean, they don't...
The PSU224 only somehow when... When you impose really the proper boundary conditions, you gain, in the end gain the PSU224, but then you've also somehow destroyed this Youngian stuff, I think. But this is just, I mean, that's the sort of thing. I mean, this is just the sort of things we ultimately want to understand from the solution. That's what I want to say.
Is one of these U1s the bonus symmetry?
Not even. It's also, I don't quite understand how the bonus really, it also has something to do with this whole thing, but I didn't mean this.
The bonus symmetry is not a symmetry of...
The bonus symmetry is not a symmetry.
No. But it's
in these are symmetries.
One of
On the supergravity,
yeah. In the full model, the hypercharge is not a symmetry. And, yeah. Okay. So now let's really let's talk business and just discuss a bit this algebra, because I want to show you how you can sort of the magnon and so on just from this algebra. And I also want to somehow, even though I know the answer, I want to give you some perspective on how the answer might look like eventually. So let's start with what's called the oscillator construction of PSU224, and that's due to originally, I guess, mostly Murat Gunaydin and co-workers. So we sort of take the fundamental representation of 2.2/4. So we take four fermions. Let's call them so CA. CB dagger anti-commutator equals delta AB, and A and B run from 1 to 4. And for the moment, I only talk about one family of these oscillators, but very soon we'll start taking tensor products. And then we take 2 plus 2 bosons, which have, of course, commutators, so A alpha dagger. A beta equals delta alpha beta, and B alpha dot dagger B beta dot equals delta alpha dot beta dot, beta dot alpha dot. Sorry, I'm already getting sloppy here, so beta alpha. And then alpha beta runs from sort of curly 1 and curly 2, and alpha dot, beta dot, and from curly 1 dot to curly 2 dot. Of course, so these 2 plus 2 oscillators here are related to the 2.2, and the 4 oscillator to the SU4. I could also, of course, formally use four. Formally, I could use four bosons. A alpha dagger A beta equals eta alpha beta alpha, where eta is diagonal 1, 1, -1, -1, right? And then an alpha beta now run from 1, curly 1, to curly 4. So now I'll make this huge table. And it will take a little bit to make it, and maybe some of you will get bored, but then I can really explain all that's known about the magnon somehow from this table. So somehow my goal is to make an 8x8 matrix, and I'll try to do that by constantly subdividing this thing. So I already did 4 times 4. A little more work, and it's 8x8. And then prevent me from erasing this thing. It's hopefully going to stay until the end of the seminar. Okay, that's it. Now we'll just use as coordinates for this table, we're going to use these 8 bosonic and fermionic oscillators. And this is some sort of huge generalization of the Schwinger representation of SU2, which you all know. Okay, so what we'll do, I'll use some funny ordering. In principle, I could order them in any way I want. And this is sort of, if it was bosonic, this would be called wild transformations if I shuffle them about. For super algebra, this is something one could call generalized wild transformation, exchanging rows and columns. So I'll put the destruction operator C1 here, so destruction C2 here, destruction C3 here, and destruction C4 here. And then destruction for these bosons 1 and 2 here. And here I do something funny. Now I could write A3 and A4 if I used this eta symbol, but I don't want to do that. So I'm just going to do B curly 2 dagger and B curly 1 dagger.
If you did delta alpha dot beta dot, you don't want a minus sign?
Here?
Yes.
I want plus.
So the minus sign just comes because you've interchanged the dagger with
that's
it.
Right, and that's how these the dagger appears up here.
Yeah.
I could use this language where I have the minus signs in here, and then I would indeed write just A1, A2, A3, A4. Okay. Now I keep going. I do C1 dagger here. I do A1 dagger here. I do curly 1. A curly 2 dagger here. Then I do C2 dagger here. C3 dagger here. Down here, C4 dagger. And here I put the destructor, the upper 2, curly 2, and the upper curly 1. Okay, so again, otherwise, if I didn't do this transformation, I mean, if I had minus signs here, it would be A3, A4 destructor, I mean, a crater here. Okay, now each of these boxes just means the product of these two guys. So let's look, for example, let's look at this kind of block here in the middle. So, for example, then I would have an A1. I want to use this block, so I'm putting A1 dagger, curly 1, A1 dagger, A2 here, and I put A, curly 2 dagger, A1 here. So then that's Schwinger's representation of SU2. I mean, this is like the, say, raising operator, and this is the lowering operator. And then when you do that and compute so what's the L0 operator, you will find that it's this, I mean, A2 dagger A2 minus A1 dagger A1, right? In fact, there's a very nice notation, namely so-called Dinkin diagram, so you could make the Dinkin diagram of SU2. where the Dynkin diagram now denotes this diagonal operator. And it's a charge. It measures the spin of this SU2. Okay? So I could call this L21, curly 2, curly 1, and this L1, curly 2. Now, if I have any object with alpha undotted alpha indices, then these generators act just canonically. So any object where I have L alpha beta commuted with some any object that carries gamma, then I have delta alpha gamma J beta. And then it's SU2 and not U2, I subtract the trace, the minus delta alpha beta J gamma. And then if the same generator acts on sort of a contravariant thing with an upper index, SU2 index, then it's delta gamma beta J alpha, but with a minus sign, because sort of the anti-fundamental representation. Anti-fundamental representation, even though in SU2 by the epsilon symbols these are related, it's useful to distinguish upper and lower. So gamma beta, and delta alpha beta, J gamma, right? So that's this SU2 algebra. And now you keep going. Then, for example, here now I have C1 dagger C2. And down here, I have C2 dagger C1. And then I can call this R21 and this R12. And then there's more such operators with R symmetry. So by the way, now, of course, down here, I have my L, another LCU2, so I have my L bar 2. I mean, L bar, you can put the indices for yourself just from this table. Here's the L bar algebra. And then there's another piece. Now I'm not writing the oscillator form and the indices. You can immediately recover this from just looking what's inside the box from the columns and rows denotation. So there's another piece of the R symmetry here. And then the remaining R symmetry generators, they sit here. Okay. And now you can ask yourself, what are the other boxes? So we are not done with the bosonic generators. There's four guys. So look what's here, for example. So here we have A1 dagger, A curly 1 dagger, A curly 2 dot dagger. So that I can call, that's P1 2 dot, and there's four P's. And this is just sort of, you can think of this as some kind of four translations of SU2, 2. And likewise, for conformal case, you could write in here. And they are clearly all given by destruction operators. And then you can put now, the rest is now supercharges, I guess, except for the diagonal guys. So you can put some S generators down here in this strip. These are all supersymmetry generators, SS, SS, SS. So there will be some supercharges QQ here, QQ here, QQ here, and QQ here. The Q bars in this table will be here. And you can see nicely from the table, of course, they are all composed of one bosonic quark and one fermionic quark. And then finally, the S bars are down here. Okay. So except for the diagonal guys, this is already all the generators of PSU224, and you can check just using the explicit, each box is some letter with some indices, and you know exactly what's oscillator, so you can do a little exercise. It doesn't take very long, maybe 2 hours.
Some S's appear in the upper.
Very strange, very strange. Mm-hmm.
So they are lowering readers.
It's very strange, but for some reason, that's the reason I'm drawing you this thing and torture you with this, because this is somehow the God-given Dynkin diagram of PSU224 in the planar limit. Because now, so I didn't write the Dynkin diagram. Now I told you that, so here's another SU2, right?
Once you choose to put the P's as raising operators, then I would expect M and K to be lowering operators and SF to be lowering operators. God cannot change it.
He cannot change it, but you can. You don't have to. For example, who tells you that? I mean, you can always change the notion of raising and lowering. And then the only reason, let me draw the Dynkin diagram, then we'll rediscuss this point. But for some reason, and that's why I'm doing this, because that's another thing that's not understood. This is the thing to do. It's not the distinguished Dynkin diagram. It's not the Dobrev-Petkova one, which you use for the representations here. It's this one. So there's another, of course, bosonic blob here. And now, if you know your Dynkin diagrams, each node can mean a diagonal guy, which is sort of the difference or the sum of these boxes, depending on statistics. And you get it by sort of commuting or anti-commuting the lowering and the raising guy. And if there's fermionic things, then you make a cross into this dot, right? So these are all fermionic dots. And now we are done with our Dynkin diagram, so the Dynkin diagram is here.
So, I mean, maybe you can say, you chose the ordering of the rows to get a certain basis for the diagonal elements.
That's right.
And I guess unlike bosonic Lie algebras, the super ones come in different forms, and you chose a particular form. Is that
right?
Correct.
So what happens if it was completely boson? So if I only use bosonic oscillators or only use fermionic, then I would get SU8. And SU8 has a Weyl group 8 factorial. And that corresponds precisely to the 8 factorial ways of ordering my 8 oscillators. Now, this being sort of in the complex form GL4/4, these reorderings are not all of the same kind. And in fact, now you see that the number of crosses will change if I do these generalized Weyl transformations, exchanging rows and columns. And this is precisely this amazing variety of Dynkin diagrams you have for the superalgebras. You can easily see that you always need at least one. So if I move all my supercharges into this upper block, then there's one cross here, and this is a distinguished Dynkin diagram. But that one is bad for the representation theory, because then you can show that sort of the Q's and the S bars are up and the Q bars and the S's are down. Something like this. And if you use the one Dobrev and Petkova used for the representation theory, then there's one cross here and one cross here. That's the one you like. And that has the advantage that now all the Q's and Q bars are up, and all the S and S bar are down. And that's great, because now raising means you increase the anomalous dimension, and lowering means you lower it, which is cool, but somehow not the thing to do. So the spin chain beyond one loop only works for this one. And there's a residual, there still is a little bit of symmetry left. And this will play a big role. I mean, now if you look, we will soon discuss this. So if you look at just this part of the diagram, then you will recognize an SU2/2. And there's another SU2/2 in this lower quadrant. And you can still have you can still basically commute one and two here. I mean, curly one and two, and non-curl Latin 1 and 2. That you can do, and you can independently do this for the other 2/2. And these discrete operations correspond to some discrete symmetries of these beta equations, which is sort of a little bit less left of all the freedom of PSU 2 to 4, but it's really not much. And that's the only thing you can do. If you want to do beta ansatz, if you don't, you can use any other Dinkin diagram. Mm-hmm.
And in what combination is the dilatation hiding in? DLs probably in the bars?
Oh, it appears in all kinds of places, but it basically appears. It appears here and here and here and here.
There are two extra U1s.
Right. Now there's also the story about the two extra U1s. I will discuss actually the U1s in a second. So basically, you would think now that you have seven U1s because there are seven nodes, but there's one more, which is actually important, and I want to talk about it. So, of course, I'm not going to write for you all the. I wrote a little bit of the algebra. I'm not going to write the whole algebra for you. It's going to take too long. But I'll still write a few relations, the ones which are kind of interesting. So first of all, what we want to do now, we want to think as sort of alpha as undotted SU2 spinners and alpha dot dotted SU2 spinners. But there's a little cheat here. Because if I do that, then I basically have replaced Lorentz group, which is SL2C, by SU2 plus SU2 bar, where this is the undotted and this is the dotted spinners. And in fact, this particular form of you're using here is a sort of, it's not. I cheated a little bit because these P's are really not the true translations in SU2,2, and these are not the true special conformal guys. Because as you know, like in SU2,2, the P's would be a perfectly Hermitian operator, so P dagger equals P. But the way it's done here, then if you take a dagger of any generator in this table, you come to the lower guy. So a P dagger would be a K, and so on. So let's call them fake Lorentz symmetry. But this fake Lorentz symmetry is somehow hugely important for ADS-CFT, which I'll discuss in a second. It's very important to be able to compare string and gauge theory. Now, having these indices, what is manifest now? What's manifest now, we have a manifest... SU2 plus SU2 bar plus a manifest SU4. Okay. Just this point about this. If you look at the closure relations of SU2, 2 using this oscillator, for example, the really interesting commutator to compute is this one here. So take a fake K with a fake P, then you get delta beta dot gamma dot L alpha beta. You get delta alpha delta L bar beta dot gamma dot. And you get 2 times delta beta dot gamma dot delta alpha delta times H. So if you commute a K with a P, you get some sort of Lorentz plus Lorentz bar rotations, and then you get this interesting extra piece, which is precisely, this is called the conformal Hamiltonian. This is a conformal Hamiltonian. Which is not the dilatation generator. So in this oscillator picture, so H would be just 1 plus 1/2 number operator A gamma dagger A gamma for the A guys plus 1/2 number operator for the dotted guys. gamma dot omega g gamma dot. Now you see, actually, in this simple, in this naive oscillator picture, it's very nice. The algebra is satisfied. But for example, it's clear that you always get conformal energies, which are sort of half-integer valued, which is not so good for gauge theory, because then we know that the dilatation weight can take any number. So we have to do something about this. And in fact, really, what that stuff is in terms of string theory, this H is really the string Hamiltonian which generates shifts. I mean, this is a generator of shifts along this time direction in ADS. And then the usual argument why you can get non-trivial stuff from there is that you go to the universal cover and this thing can wrap many, many times. And then in this direction, of course, you have an S3, which has symmetry SO4, and this is precisely SU2 plus SU2 bar. So somehow this is this what's called sort of the maximal, so the SU2,2 is sort of splattered about here. I mean, a piece is here, a piece is here, a piece is here, and a piece is here. And this together makes sort of the maximal compact form of SU2,2, something like this. Okay. Now, this thing is not as symmetric as it should be. And in fact, to really make progress with the spin chain, you have to do something violent to the SU4 symmetry. But you have to do what condensed matter people call a particle hole transformation. So what you should do is actually you should replace the C3 destruction generator by a new creation operator, which you call D, with a dotted index. And you do the same for C4. Okay. And then, likewise, of course, down here, C3 dagger will become destruction D upper 2. And C4 dagger will come D1 dot. Now, what's nice about this manipulation is that suddenly, you see, here we clearly have die creation operators in these A's. Now, when you do this particle hole transformation, which condensed matter people like to do all the time, in a series of strongly correlated electrons, then you see that this box is precisely all die creation operators. This stuff down here is all die annihilation operators. And in here, it's all nicely sort of creation annihilation. That would also still be true for the one you like, the Dobrev-Petkova.
So in other words, you're just redefining what the vacuum is.
Now we've redefined what the vacuum is. And in fact, that's what we sort of going to discuss now. So
which is sort of innocuous for fermions, but a little bit more tricky for bosons.
Well, for the bosons, I sort of already done it, because from the beginning I used these things. But now I have recovered my symmetry somehow. And somehow, if I want to do this with the bosons, I should somehow do this with the fermions. But then I break my SU4 and make part of the SU4 non-manifest. Okay. So maybe how you can. This is now good enough. So this oscillator picture is perfect for zero loop Young-Mills theory.
This oscillator picture gives you the algebra.
Absolutely. It really, we will write a few more relations in a second, but it basically really gives you PSU224 with sort of funny hermeticity conditions, but these are fine all I'm saying is that these P's are not the true generators of translation in SU2,2. And so on, but this is one.
Just for my eyes, is it not true? Is it a shadow lie or is it something?
No, it's this hermeticity stuff. A translation p mu, the p mu, right? I want to write something. Like in the true theory, I want to write replace. This is runs from 0 to 3, and I want to replace this into by a vial by spinner. Mm-hmm. Now this alpha beta dot, if this lives in Minkowski, I really these live in SL2C. But so basically, in terms of the what's happening here in terms of the SO, so SU2,2 is SO2,4, right? So if we label these coordinates here by sort of 0, 1, 2, 3 for sort of the space-time part, and then a direction 5 and 6, then basically the SL2C is this one. And what I've done here is I basically don't do that, but I sort of pretend that my I pretend that my Lorentz group is actually this part here with all plus directions. So the symmetric here is of course minus plus 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 minus. And then this is a nice SO4 which falls into these two SU2s. And then you see there's another sort of U1, which is precisely this one here, this circle here. But basically, the conformal Hamiltonian then is basically, so H is sort of the U1 charge related to these two guys, while dilatation is really, true dilatation is the thing related to 5, 6. Which is this is a compact generator and this is a non-compact generator. And in order to get something non-trivial here I always can get something non-trivial. In order to get something non-trivial here, I need to go to the universal cover. Okay. Now let's see. So this is good enough to sort of see all the fields of n equals 4. It's good for many, many things. You can sort of discuss string theory with this, and you can discuss gauge theory with this. So I'll mostly discuss gauge theory, and then so let's see how the fields work out in here. Let's take a spin chain. Let's take a spin chain, an n equals 4 spin chain at g Young loads equals 0, and let's take one side. So a single generation of these generators. Then, for example, if I to this guy, then I would say that this is a field strength of Young. So basically what I'm doing is also I decompose the F mu nu into an F symmetric F alpha beta, F alpha dot beta dot. Again, these are sort of fake, and what I'm doing is sort of fake gauge fields, not the true gauge fields, but because I've used this. If you complexify, then you don't have these problems. Then you can do an A alpha dagger, C B dagger. That would be a fermion. And clearly there's three components here, right? So this is 3 plus 3 components, and there's of course 6 components of F mu nu. Then you can see a dagger, C B dagger. This is just anti-symmetric thing running over 4 indices. So this is our 6 scalars. So this is 6 scalars. This is 8 fermions. Then I have B alpha dot dagger, epsilon A, B, C, D, C, B dagger, C, C dagger, CD dagger, which I can call a barred fermion, alpha dot A, which is another 8 formulas. And then finally, I can do B alpha dot dagger B eta dot dagger. So this is all gonadin, basically. So this would be F bar alpha dot beta dot, the other three components of the gauge field. Okay. And then out of these, so this is sort of already the basic Young-Mills multiplet. You see the field strength, you see the 8 plus 8 equals 16 fermions, and you see the 6 scalars. Okay. Now it's very interesting, and then of course I can build infinitely many new fields from this by acting with covariant derivatives. In my case, I act with fake covariant derivatives. So then I can act with, so I already did this here. So now I say a translation is like a derivative. So I can take any number of covariant derivatives, d alpha beta dot, which would be just a alpha dagger b beta dot dagger. And now you see also why I chose my fermions for sort of R-symmetry stuff and the bosons for the SU2,2 stuff, because I want to be able to pump infinitely many derivatives into my system in order to get the infinite multiplets of n equals 4. Right? From any field, I can take any number of derivatives. All the physical representations of n equals 4 are infinite modules and always create infinitely many descendants by acting with these d's. And I could only do that if I use bosonic oscillators, not fermionic oscillators. Okay? Now, it's very interesting. I did this funny particle hole transformation. So let's do that. And then you very slowly will see the spin chain emerging. So what I'm doing is now I'll tell you sort of what is one spin of PSU224. Because this is too many fields. So something very interesting happens. So basically, I can start with some fog vacuum, right? Fog vacuum, which is killed by all, I mean, destruction. A alpha on 0 is 0, B alpha dot on 0 is 0, and all the fermions on 0 is 0. That's actually a funny vacuum. It's killed by all these destruction operators. But this vacuum, nevertheless, is not PSU224 invariant because I have these die creation operators. So it's actually very hard to build these infinite dimensional representations and then find the PSU224 invariant vacuum. I actually don't know how to do that. And it's related to all our problems, I'm sure. So this is not, zero is not, is neither a state in the Young-Mills theory, nor is it an invariance thing. There should be exactly one vacuum because we know there's an identity operator, right? But I don't know how to find it. Okay.
With these the bosons, you've switched the creation and radiation of the boson.
Yeah. Right.
You should apply an infinite number of
different. If I use these guys, I could do it, of course.
When did Gunaidin do this? Because Ferber did this, I don't know, 76.
I mean, I think the specific, I don't know the history. I mean, the specific construction, I think these oscillators in physics were mostly used first by Gunaidin and Bars, I think. And then there's this paper from 84 or so where Gunaidin and Marcus did it specifically for. Yeah. Anyway, let me not get in. I even don't know the history, but you are completely right. Another way of looking at it is as twisters. I mean, this oscillator is nothing but twisters. Okay. So now, if you use a new vacuum. Let's call that Z. And let's just pick C3 dagger, C4 dagger, like that. So then, now on this new vacuum, you will see that actually now these six scalars split up in a funny way. There will be sort of one guy like that, which is not an accident. This is one of the complex scalars of n equals 4, this famous Z scalar. And then there's a whole bunch of generators which are obtained by acting two times as a generator on this new vacuum, okay? And these are basically in the scalar sectors. These are C A dagger, D A dot dagger, and this is nothing but my X bar, Y bar. And then I also have, for my fermions here, I have A alpha dagger D A dot dagger. And for these fermions, and there's, you can clearly see that there is four of them. And down here, I have C A dagger D alpha dot dagger. And so this is another four fermions. And then we had eight fermions. The other four fermions are now obtained by, after vacuum change, by acting with four oscillators. Okay? So in the case of this guy, this is C1 dagger, C2 dagger, D1 dot dagger, D2 dot dagger. And this is nothing but Z bar. Okay? And then the other four fermions here, they are A alpha dagger, C A dagger, D1 dot dagger, D2 dot dagger, and another four fermions. And down here, it's B alpha dot dagger, B beta dot dagger, C1 dagger, C2 dagger. And then finally, all these field strengths, they contain four oscillators. So A alpha dagger, A beta dagger, B1 dot dagger, B2 dot dagger, and down here, B alpha dot dagger, B beta dot dagger, C1 dagger, C2 dagger. So in fact, and now we slowly move in onto our spin chain and so on and so forth, because now you see what we have here. Here we have four fermions. Here we have four fermions. And here we have another four bosons. And down there, we also have precisely four bosons, these derivatives. Now that's somehow what becomes the spins of the spin chain, the magnons. So these are all sort of magnons. In zero loop gauge theory, I mean, and this I have to add these four magnons. So these are
the second column is acting on all
the second column.
What operators are acting on that state Z or on
the they act on Z, yeah.
But
you can see this. I mean, because, for example, you can see that these guys, they are actually in the old language, they kill one fermion, but I've put two in, so one is left, and then I'm back to this description with one boson, one fermion of this type, and so on. It all works out nicely. But you see now, what's very, very nice now is when we go back to our picture here. After this particle hole transformation now, there's another interpretation you can give now to the generators in this block here, because they are all dicreation. And these eight generators precisely create these 4 plus 4 plus 4 plus 4 derivatives. So in fact, I mean, let's write it so in the new language. So this will be four derivatives, B, D, DD. This is our X field. and let's make a sort of a plus. Let's make plus to mean that I to denote that I'm creating these guys. So here I create my Y field. Here I create my Y bar field. And here I create my X bar field. And these superchargers, they all precisely create 4 barred and 4 unbarred fermions. Okay? And then the guy down here, they are the reverse. I'm just writing in one case, and you can fill in the rest. So likewise, this is a die annihilation operator. So this guy creates one on this spin chain of side one X magnon, and this guy kills the X magnon. Okay. So. Okay, and now let's start doing the spin chain. Oh, but there's maybe I should say a few more things about before I finally explain you the spin chain and the beta anwärts in this language. I should say just a few more things on the algebra.
It's obvious that these magnons are the excitation, for instance, in the PP wave background. They are the 8 oscillators.
That exactly, and we'll also I want to discuss that. So maybe hold on 1 second.
I have a question actually. Uh-huh. The beginning F A dot alpha dot beta dot looks a little bit asymmetric with respect to F alpha beta. Because it has 4 C oscillators.
One.
The last one.
This one, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what would be wrong if I applied only B alpha dot dagger, B beta dot dagger? Is that related maybe to the U1 that's quotient?
Well, this is related to the central charge, and that's exactly, again, this is something I want to explain now, because then the central charge constraint is not satisfied, and I don't have a multiplet of PSU224, only of SU2,2/4. So if you look at the closure relations, so we'll have to do a little bit more algebra. So now these superchargers, of course, they satisfy plenty of relations. So for example, you can recover the usual supersymmetry relations, A alpha dot, sort of 4 copies of Weisberger type superchargers, delta B A, P alpha dot. Beta, so the usual statement that Q bar with Q gives a momentum, and then there's N equals 4 supersymmetry, so this index here runs from 1 to 4. And the interesting, again, just like this is the interesting relation for the conformal guy, the interesting one is for the super stuff is the closure relations. So you should work out, and I'm starting running a little bit out of time, so let me spare the indices, which you can easily recover from my table. So it's delta times Lorentz plus another delta times R symmetry plus delta times delta times 1/2 conformal Hamiltonian minus the 2,2/4 central charge and the S bar with the Q bar equals delta times L bar plus minus actually delta times symmetry plus delta times 1/2 H minus C 2,2/4 central charge. So this is analogous to this guy, right? K with P gives you just some stupid rotations plus the Hamiltonian, and S with Q again gives sort of a little bit of Lorentz, a little bit of R symmetry, plus basically half, that's very important, the Hamiltonian, and a little bit of Lorentz, a little bit of R, plus again half of the Hamiltonian. The half is very important. And in addition, also what's very important is this minus and plus here. I think it is actually, but So now let's just write down this the generator, the central charge, which is also, this is very instructive. So the C2,2/4 central charge. In the old notation, I mean, where I haven't done the particle hole transformation, is 1 minus 1/2 A alpha dagger, A alpha, plus 1/2 B alpha dot dagger, B alpha dot, minus 1/2 CC dagger, CC. Now this C runs from 1 to 4 in this notation, okay? And this has to be 0 in order to reduce from SU2,2/4 to PSU2,2/4, which is a true symmetry. And now something very interesting happens when you do this particle hole transformation. By the way, this 1, of course, also comes from doing my vacuum change originally to implement the non-compact stuff. And again, you see it's kind of very ugly and unsymmetric. So once I somehow change vacuum from 4As to A and B, I should also really change vacuum here, obscuring my SU4, though, okay? And then I find something quite nice. I find 1/2. And it's nice because it tells you something about the magnum, as I'll explain in a second. So it's just number operators for the undotted guys minus the number operators for the dotted guys minus number operators for the undotted guys. So now, of course, it only runs from 1 to 2 of this change. So only 2 C's left. Now you see that what does the P in PSU 2 to 4 mean? The P in PSU 2 to 4 means that we have confinement. So basically, C equals 0, 4/4 equals 0, means confinement of quarks. So in order to make a valid state, I should only always have the same amount of dotted and undotted objects. Okay? And that's of course precisely the case if you can check it from this table here. And you can check it from my 4+4+4+4 magnons. They all contain exactly one undotted and one dotted guy, where I don't care. It could be, you know, there's also a dotted undotted for the R symmetry. Okay? Now you see, actually, the way I wrote these closure relations here was still in the 2,2/4 language. Another very interesting thing that happens is when I go to my 2,2/2+2 language. Again, I'm omitting now indices for lack of time, but using this table, you can very easily put them back. If I go to the, so this is sort of, this was the language 2,2/4. Now, if I use 2,2/2+2, and I think you know what I mean, something interesting happens. Something interesting happens to the S and Q in this 2/2 blocks, but not to the other ones. So something nice happens to half of these closure relations. So what is the nice thing that happens? You get S with Q now only in these 2/2 blocks is delta times Lorentz plus delta times R symmetry, but in the new language, so this is on an SU2 now, not an SU4, plus delta times 1/2 times H minus R charge J. Each Z field carries an R charge J. Minus C2,2/2+2. And the corresponding thing happens here. X delta L bar. There was actually a minus sign which gets repaired also under this, interestingly, under this under this particle Hall transformation because of fermion's anticommute. So that's again plus delta delta times 1/2 h minus j minus c 2.2/2+2. So why is this interesting? Because now you can see now you can also really not only talk about zero loop gauge theory, you can also talk about the very, very extreme other end, namely BMN theory. Because what happens now is you see in the BMN limit, of course, you take the R charge J to infinity, you take an infinite string of that field. And then likewise, you get a divergence in the full Hamiltonian. But it's just for those S and Qs in these two slash two blocks here, this is compensated because I made my particle Hall transformation destroying the SU4 and recovering two SU2s. So that's why you can see that. So everything is completely finite as far as these 2.2/2 blocks is concerned. Now that cannot be said, unfortunately, for the S and Q and S bar of Q bar, which sit in these unfortunate blocks here. But now you see something very funny happens there as well, because if I take an S and a Q, which is not in the 2.2/2s, then I really get a divergence here. It's not compensated from my particle Hall transformation. These are finite SU2 rotations, so it basically kills these two things. Then as a final step, I do a renormalization of my operators. I basically divide by the sort of square root of the Hamiltonian S and Q. And then you see that basically I get something with something equals delta. And this is just oscillators. So you've killed the Lie algebra. You've killed the 2.2/4 Lie algebra in this part and in this part, just making each of these magnons truly an oscillator, just a harmonic oscillator. And that's the correct structure in the BMN limit. The symmetry in the BMN limit is a 2/2 plus 2/2 plus a U1, which is now this no longer H, but H minus J, plus just 16 harmonic oscillators, 8 plus 8. It's obviously just free oscillators. So that's how this works in this picture. And really, in this opposite limit, our 16 magnons just become completely free particles. And that's supported by, if you look at more closely, all the S matrix and all that stuff just becomes one. And they don't, except for statistics, don't interact anymore. Okay? So indeed, my 16 magnons have become free oscillators in this extreme BMN limit. Nevertheless, in the sort of in the zero loop gauge theory, they are composed of these two things, which are glued together by my central charge constraint. Yeah. Okay. So now I somehow have to speed up. Back from BMN to the spin chain, because unfortunately so far I only discussed the spin chain of length 1. So now we want to take tensor products. And when you take now tensor products of this oscillator picture, as long as you stay with Chi Lang Yang Mills is 0, everything is fine. You get the correct multiplet structure. Unfortunately, it's no longer fine when you switch on Chi Yang Mills, because then some of these generators pick up corrections. And actually, it's very ironic, but somehow it's still not really known. Even the leading correction for the full algebra in this oscillator picture is not known. Nevertheless, you can, with some tricks, you can, for example, find the correction to the Hamiltonian and write it in this oscillator picture. So let's see where I write that. So basically what you want to do now is let's take not just one side, but any number of sides. So you can think of, let's say this is L equals 1, this is L equals 2, and so on. We label the sites. That means I have to take families now. I put another index on these oscillators, spin chain index. Okay, and now the leading order, my quarks are completely confined. So, for example, if I put in this slot a C2 dagger, D2 dot dagger, this is nothing but an X. So each of these blobs means secretly a Z, but the Z is kind of gone. It's kind of emptied, so it's like looks like an empty lattice, but each of these points represents a Z field. I'm working on the new vacuum. So if I put on this vacuum a C2 dagger, D2 dot dagger, it means, according to my table, inserting an X magnon, which sits just there, and so on. I mean, if I, then I, you can put an A2 dagger, an A2 dot, a B2 dot dagger. Then I've inserted a derivative D2 2 dot, right? But secretly, this thing, one is, of course, secretly is acting on the Z field sitting at the side. But in this picture, it's not important. It's just sort of like looks like a derivative that doesn't act on anything. Okay. And again, like at one loop, at zero loops, this is completely consistent. These things don't move. Now, when you switch on radiative corrections, these things no longer are eigenstates. And you have to diagonalize it. And the way it's been done so far is that you really you insist on this central charge constraint always being zero. And then when you do that, these oscillators start to jump around. But they jump around in a funny way. So in particular, for example, because I have this permanent confinement, I cannot just move one oscillator like that. I have to move them in pairs. Now, there are some very complicated rules for this jumping. It's really not stated much, so maybe I'll just write it for you. The jumping rules are such that... So basically, what you do is you now write like H minus classical dimension equals G squared sum from, say, from 1 to J, HL, L plus 1, some kind of Hamiltonian density. This G squared is the top coupling divided by 16 pi squared. And then basically this Hamiltonian density gives you some jumping rules. And it's really a sum over these jumps, keeping, I'm sort of writing a little bit symbolically, keeping the C at L, the 4/4c equals 0, and keeping the c at L plus 1, 4/4 equals 0. So if there's n times some weight, there's a weight for no jump. So this weight is, if there's no jump, it's just 2 times harmonic number of n over 2, where n, so I should also say that n is the total number of oscillators in in L plus 1, so to speak, on both sides. The harmonic number is defined as h of n equals psi of n plus 1 minus psi of 1, where psi of x equals d by dx log x, psi function, gamma of x, psi function. And this is also just 1 plus 1 half plus 1 over n. If they jump, it's 2 times a minus sign. Now let's also say number L plus 1 is number of oscillators from L to L plus 1. And L plus 1 L is number of oscillators from L plus 1 to L. I just want to show you what's behind this one loop spin chain even to challenge you to find the generalization to all loops. So So as a sign, product of the jumps are from left to right and right to left, and then times some funny gamma functions, gamma of n l l plus 1 plus n l l plus 1 l over 2 times gamma of 1 plus n l n minus n l l plus 1 minus n l plus 1 l over 2 divided by gamma of 1 plus n over 2. So you get some fairly complicated jumping rules for all these oscillators, always under the constraints that they have to hop in pairs appropriately to keep the central charge constraints and keep the magnon picture. And now you can do now you can start doing your beta antithesis. You can, when you want to diagonalize this Hamiltonian to one loop, you just do a Fourier transform. So if you have a single magnon, it's very simple. You do a Fourier transform, and then from these rules, you will immediately see that for a single magnon, the action of this density is just, I mean, HL plus 1, L plus 1 for a single is just the identity on LL plus 1 minus the permutation on LL plus 1. So if you have a single, it doesn't matter what kind of magnon you have. The quarks will jump in either do nothing or jump to left or right with a minus sign, independently of whether they're boson or fermion. And therefore, you can, I'm sure you all have seen this, you can do your beta ansatz now and find the dispersion for these magnons, which are permanently confined quarks. And then you'll find stuff like, for a single magnon, you can just have a wave function psi of L equals e to the IPL, and you will find that this shift in energy, let's call the eigenvalue here E, then E is just 2 times g squared times 2 for doing nothing minus jump to the left minus jump to the right, which is easily computed to be just the famous 8g squared sine squared p over 2, the one loop dispersion law for a single magnon. And then when you have two magnons, things get interesting. But actually, funnily, not so much more interesting. It's a little work. But actually, most of that complicated stuff, the Hamiltonian, you don't need. Because these rules give you, like, if you have lots of quarks here and lots of quarks here, and these messy things they do when they come close to each other. But if you have just two magnons, you only have four quarks. So there's not much you need to work this out. So then you will find a wave function, say L1, L2, equals, so the first guess is P1, L1, plus IP2, L2. And this would be a solution if there was no interaction at all, but there's this dangerous point when the oscillators are close. So you actually have to add the reflected wave. This is S matrix, P2, P1. E to the I P2 L1 plus I P1 L2. And here's our S matrix at one loop. And you can work it out. You can work it out by using almost nothing from that Hamiltonian. You need almost no information. And it's actually still, it's a big matrix because there's 16 magnons. So the incoming state is 16 squared, has 16 squared polarizations, right? Because, I mean, two magnons coming in. And this goes out with another possible 16 squared polarization. So this matrix, S here, is 16 squared times 16 squared. It's a big matrix. In fact, it would be even bigger if I really talked about all these quarks and so on. But most of the elements here are zero because they always have to jump in pairs. Okay. And now, So now I would need another lecture to actually start talking about more than one loop. So but just what you can learn from here, from this exercise, you can work out the S-matrix in this picture. It's a little subtle. You have to be careful, because in details, these magnons are a little bit different. So if you have an X, two X magnons, they cannot jump on top of each other, for example. But if you have two D magnons, they can jump, because they both contain bosons. So there's some intricate stuff going on. And in fact, this waveform, I cheated a little bit. This is actually not quite right. There's some sort of contact terms you have to add to get Bethe's wave function right, and to take into account this different nature of these magnons. So it's a little bit of a cheat. But still, in the end, there is this notion in the infinite system of this S-matrix. And this notion works also in the completely finite system, because this interactions here are just nearest neighbor, and there's just no problem of closing this asymptotic S-matrix at one loop into a circle, and it's just the final solution of the one-loop problem. The question is only, okay, it's a solution, but again, you've assumed integrability. So what we showed a number of years back is that actually this problem is fully integrable, in the sense that if I take three magnons, you really have a factorization of the three-body S-matrix, and so on and so forth. And you see, precisely for this factorization, you need all this messy stuff. You don't need it to compute the S-matrix, but if you want to prove integrability, you somehow have to deal with all this messy stuff. And if you just truncate your Hamiltonian, ignoring the jump rules for more than four quarks, you will find the very same two-body S-matrix. You will check that it satisfies Young-Baxter, you will write a paper, be happy, and you will have done a mistake. Because then, if somebody works out the three-body S-matrix with some Hamiltonian that these other terms are missing, he will find that it doesn't factorize. And that's sort of the situation, in some sense, we are in more than one loop, because there we just somehow, well, it's even worse, because you see, the two-loop Hamiltonian is not known. It's known in some special cases with some subsets of quarks, but not for the full set of eight quarks. So nobody has done a Bethe ansatz to check, nobody has done a coordinate Bethe ansatz to check our S matrix from two loop, because the two loop Hamiltonian is not known. I'm sure it's an intricate thing somehow. So what you can do is you can just assume integrability and then think about, assume it, never even discuss the three-body S-matrix, because it's too complicated. Just try to find the two-body S-matrix, and then check as a consistency condition that it satisfies Young-Baxter. That doesn't mean that the true three-body S-matrix really factorizes in these pieces.
But you've got a higher and higher loop, you get more and more long.
That's right, you get more long range.
Any finite chain is only
Well, for a finite change, the S matrix picture breaks down, and then in the S matrix picture in this magnon language breaks down, and then you can anyway, I should wrap up. Can I have like three more minutes or two?
Yes.
Yeah. So I didn't cover all I wanted to say, but
about factorization, you do know that you have higher charges, right? So you do know that if you apply some charge Q3, you expect that if you prepare this, like this notion that you prepare three-wave packets and you act on with a higher charge and it slightly shifts, and therefore you get factorizability.
No, but what I'm saying
also
is...
Also at Q3, even though you didn't check, you expect it to factorize because you have higher charges.
But not for the full model.
For the full model?
I'm talking here. Today I only... as you noticed, there were no sectors. I just tried to give you the picture of the whole thing. I never talked about any sectors. I mean, just the whole thing. And the statement is correct. For the whole thing, we don't know even the two-loop Hamiltonian. And anyway, just to wrap it up a little bit, sort of tell you what I wanted to say and didn't have time. So now you can go a lot further now with this picture, actually. And I already gave you a hint about how the BMN thing comes out here. What you can also do is you can now just insist on this Macron picture, just brutally setting these central charges to zero, because they should be zero. And then actually the symmetry definitely will be 2/2. I mean, if you pick a Z vacuum, the symmetry will be 2/2 times 2/2 bar. Okay. You will see that in this case, if I kill these central charges, in this case and in this case only, suddenly the two/2 are not completely disconnected because they share this diagonal operator. And actually, after reduction to 2/2 squared, this combination H minus J actually becomes the central charge of each 2/2. Because actually, certainly the Hamiltonian, the full theory is not a central charge, right? So you want to compute something. But in this reduction, H minus J becomes a central charge with respect to the smaller subalgebras, 2/2 times 2/2 bars. By the way, and that's something we sometimes discussed. I mean, from this picture, now I don't have time. I wanted to explain it today, but I didn't have. You can definitely show that also the 2/2 plus 2/2 is the full symmetry, even at finite j, z to the j. Now to make progress, you have to do something very curious, which somehow Niklas Beiser guessed, and I guess, I just don't understand what it means. Because what you have to do is you have to actually extend each of these 2/2s by 2 further central charges. That could also be nicely explained here. Basically, you sort of twist the S and the Qs somehow, and you twist the S bar and the Q bar somehow. This leads to the fact that then here the 1/2 can be deformed into something which no longer has to be quantized in half integer units. So you can get non-trivial anomalous dimensions A minus J. But the consequence is that actually Q is Q and S is no longer zero. It in fact becomes a further central charge, which sometimes called P, not to be confused with the translation, and S with S also becomes another central charge. Let's call it P dagger. It's the dagger of this one. And so you need to centrally extend. And the 2/2 algebra has a unique algebra which has a triple central extension. So we have 3 central charges. We have this central charge here, and this central charge here. And now it's completely mysterious how this extension fits into 2/2. In fact, it doesn't fit. It just does not fit. So it's not part of the symmetry. So you're somehow going a little bit off shell or off the algebra to do your thing. And then in the very end, you demand that on the full state, P should be zero and P dagger should be zero. There's a nice constraint for these 3 central charges, because just from algebra, from this twisting procedure, you can show that H minus J squared minus P times P dagger has to be 1/4, which ultimately, when you solve it, leads to this dispersion law, but only if you say how these central charges P and P dagger are related to the spin chain momentum. And that's completely, I mean, just you write it down because I guess you know what you want to get, but it's not clear where it comes from. So basically you have to extend this thing and then you find the S matrix, which is triply extended 2/2 plus 2/2 bar symmetry, the two-body S matrix. Then the machine runs, and amazingly, you find a unique result, which happens to be a tensor product of 2 of Shastri's R matrices of the Hubbard model, interestingly. Hubbard model has a 16x16 R matrix, and this factorizes, so you get 2 copies of this Shastri. And then you just cross your fingers, make a Bethe ansatz with that, get some nested Bethe equation, and this is our equations. And this works, except if the operator is too short, and then it only works up to a certain order. And then you build some machine. So you put in this asymptotic Bethe ansatz, And then somehow you get the exact spectrum. This machine is called TBA, and we'll hear about this on Thursday. So the input, as far as I understand, is this asymptotic beta ansatz, which by itself, as I tried to convince you, is, I mean, on shaky grounds. It's just somehow guessed. And then if this machine works, you will get the exact spectrum. But it will not. It will remain obscure. Why this thing is integrable. I mean, it's to show integrability. You see here in one loop, you can really show that this Hamiltonian leads to some Young-Baxter symmetry and so on and so forth. So, and then like Joe yesterday, he said that indeed integrability usually means that one finds some kind of beta wave function, and you can do this at one loop, and you can guess how to do this beyond. But you cannot do it with this, in this Magnon picture in the finite volume. Now, nevertheless, it still seems like you can somehow get exact results. And this was shown in the last half year by Yannick and now by Volodya and Pedro. But that is even more obscure because now we just don't know sort of what sort of Young-Baxter symmetry leads to this TBA to work out. So, but maybe Volodya will have more to say about this. So thanks.
Could you just say another word about this?
The central charge?
Putting in and then taking out.
Yeah, that's correct. So what you do is you twist.
N equal to 2 as a central charge.
So what happens is, so basically take one. So 2 slash 2 is really a unique algebra in that respect. So what happens is that if you take one copy of these two, and then you twist. So the one relation is you have this one here, and so you have this one here. And we also, in principle, have this equals 0 and this equals 0, right? So now do some twist where you say that you define some new supercharges. Let me not write indices to save time because it's really late. So basically, you do A times Q plus B, and you use 2 times an epsilon symbol. You use the fact, you see, 2 slash 2 is 2 SU2s, and SU2 has epsilon symbols. So you can use these epsilon symbols to also add the S charge here. And then you do the same thing that the S tilde equals C times epsilon Q plus D times S. So if B and C are 0 and A and D equals 1, you're back to the other one. Otherwise, you've twisted it. Now, just use the anti-commutation relations, the old ones, for S with Q, and demand that you still get delta times Lorentz plus delta times R. Then you will immediately find that this can only be true if AD minus BC equals 1. But you will find that if AD minus BC is 1, that this is fine, this is fine. And interestingly, the one half H minus J gets replaced by one half H minus J times AD plus BZ. And the price you pay is, however, that you no longer have PSU 2 slash 2, but now you have Q. Q is A times B times precisely again A times D. Wait, how to say this? Well, times 1, basically. And S times S equals C times D times 1. So this central extension, it's no longer 2 slash 2, because these things are not satisfied. But it has the advantage that somehow you can move away from this 1 half. Now the real powerful thing that comes now is when you now take tensor products of this guy, then sort of on individual spin chain sites, roughly speaking, it's actually not the spin chain, it's already one level up higher in the beta ansatz, but you can sort of, you always find non-vanishing QQ and SS, but adding it all up, you can show that precisely for these cyclic states, which are somewhere related to trace cyclicity and therefore gauge invariance, the total QQ can vanish and the total SS can vanish. The only thing is you really have to figure out, or you have to guess in the end, how, what is A, B, C, D. And the way that works is that if you see how supercharges actually act, how supercharges act on Young-Mills fields, you'll find that they always act like with a G Young-Mills times basically one of the complex scalars AB. I mean, there's this R symmetry ADC times an epsilon tensor. I mean, there's an epsilon from the dotted stuff, and from the so in other words, sort of the off-shell algebra is such that actually when you act on fields with two supercharges, anti-commutator, indeed you create an extra field. And this is, you can sort of simulate that by using these kind of extra central charges. And then, of course, again, in the end, we know for the full algebra that sort of on individual fields it does that, but on the full gauge invariant operator, Q with Q has to be zero. Just like here now, in the full operator, Q with Q has to be zero. The question still is, this is sort of only the leading order thing, and in principle, people think it's nonlinear and there's infinitely many corrections. What amazingly happens here is that somehow you can really, basically you do something in the end, you say that A times B, let me get this right, is something like A times G Young-Mills, I mean G gauge coupling, times E to the I minus IP momentum of this magnon minus 1. Now, why this is really, why you should choose that, I don't know. I mean, then you get the dispersion law of the magnon, and it sort of simulates that. There's a similar story on the gauge side, I mean the string side, where people kind of, if you take this Sewell-Sheaf momentum, that you can sort of argue that this is a natural wave. But if you bought the central extension in the first place, this is kind of a natural choice. But again, just as a warning, I mean, nothing is proved here, because it seems in this new model, again, this is related to what I said in the very beginning. Presumably here, this is not just G, but some complicated function of C. Of the gauge coupling in these new CFT3 models. Again, another conjecture, you do this, and then you get this asymptotic picture for the magnets. But to my mind, it's completely obscure what the central extension means in the 2.2/4 context at finite J. So.
There's another talk in 10 minutes for those. Okay. So I think we should stop it.